Accession number 32716, reel 3.
Back at the crash site, the weather is still clear. And after 3 weeks of work, the recovery team finally has some luck. One of the local hunters spots what he thinks could be a grave.
He said that it looks like a grave, you know? He said that it looks like the same hole near up on the hill, so it looks like weird.
Right.
With the sharp edges.
Yeah,
yeah.
Just follow the edge, make it 8 inches.
Perhaps the KGB buried some remains back in the 1960s when they desecrated the site. Wishful thinking? Anne tries to keep an open mind.
I never think anything's red herring anymore. I always follow every lead, just because if you have a doubt, then you've got a bias. And I just think that you shouldn't go into any scientific endeavor with any bias at all. You have to keep an open mind up until the last day.
So what you're going to do about it?
We'll have to follow through and dig these depressions.
Three potential grave sites are marked out, and the team starts digging. Will the remains of radio man Sam Crown or the other crew members be unearthed here? It will take most of a day to excavate these grave sites.
Okay, more. So basically,
as time passes, anticipation turns to disappointment. No human remains are uncovered.
It looks as though this was a lead that I'm glad we looked into, but it's not going to lead us anywhere as far as remains are concerned.
But suddenly, only a few yards closer to the wreckage, there's a genuine breakthrough.
Ann. Oh, yeah. It is definitely a vertebra, thoracic vertebra again.
Several important bones are found. Out of respect to the families, Anne asked Nova not to film the bones as they are removed from the ground. Later, she explained what they found.
Okay, what I have here is a sketch map, very schematic, of the site. Basically, different things are going on. We have the excavated area, which is this square shape here. And within that, we have the outline of the wreckage. And the little letters dispersed around the wreckage are actually where remains were found. And you can see they're clustered near the large piece of wreckage. So I think that served as a protection for them from the elements, from other creatures that were around the area. We found remains there, human remains, and the most important in my mind were two right clavicles. I know from the anatomy of it, they're both right, that we have two people for sure represented at the site.
The recovery team also found part of a flying boot with navigator Donald Llewellyn's name on it. But it was discovered about 300 yards north of the crash site. Why so far away?
It shows that the site was disturbed by animals and was probably dragged away from its initial location. So it's another indicator that there was disturbance going on here.
The most likely animal to have removed human remains from the crash site is the brown bear, and there are signs that the bears are coming closer to the campsite.
Oh, boy.
These animals dominate here, and they are at the top of the food chain. They're above us, and they would make a small matter of us if they encountered us in this field here. And it's actually sort of invigorating to be out here amongst the animals and realize that you don't run the show here, and they're telling you that by coming into our camp and doing this. It's their country, they own it. We are guests here.
Did bears play a role in the disappearance of the crew? Could that explain the scarcity of human remains at the crash site? It's a chilling thought. And not one that Tom Raines has to contemplate. after traveling for 72 hours. He has only just arrived at the camp. But a fierce storm has followed him there. Overnight, several tents belonging to the recovery team have blown over.
I think it got around 40 degrees last night, and the tents are not holding up. So there's a lot of concerns about people's health and safety right now, and that's obviously the first thing we have to take care of before anything else happens.
Anne's team will catch a Russian helicopter to Petropavlovsk. They'll come back in a few days when the weather clears to finish up and secure the site. Then they'll return to the laboratory in Hawaii with all the bones they've collected. On board is Major General Roland LaJoy, chief of MIA recovery missions in Russia for the U.S. military.
Now, are you okay here? Or do you want to go back on the helicopter?
We want to see the site.
You have not been there yet.
No. Are you ready to spend another night here? Because they may not get a second flight in. The weather's turning for the best.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. If we have to, we'll check it out. Okay. I want to get to that site.
Tom, you really shouldn't have high expectations that there will be significant skeletal remains of your dad. I think the nature of the crash, the 56 years that have elapsed, the prevalence of wild animals around here, argue against, significant remains. But hopefully there will be some remains that, with the help of DNA, can be specifically linked to your bloodline, and then those will get a proper resting spot in Arlington.
If it's just one, that's all it takes. That's all I'm really interested in. And that would be, I think, enough closure with the military funeral at Arlington. Yeah. That would certainly be enough for me.
The fate of Tom's father and the rest of the crew of Bomber 31 will be determined here at the Central Identification Lab in Hawaii, where the bones will be processed. The only way to identify individual remains from these small fragments of bone is to extract their DNA. It won't be easy. The bones are old, and so is the DNA.
And then we'll then try to cut a 5 to 8 gram sample from out of the bone. Don't necessarily need as much as that, but that would be optimum because there's probably not much DNA left in this bone because of the degradation.
After the bone is cut into small pieces, it's ground up and put into a solution to release the DNA. It's then scanned by a computer and compared with the DNA from blood samples given by family members. They're looking for a genetic match between the two. It will take months to get all the results, but the preliminary reports are turning out better than the lab expected.
This person came back pretty nice results. We got a group of 3 samples together. They all have the same polymorphisms. So that's one individual.
The second batch of samples contains unique sections of DNA that can be matched to a second individual. But many of the bone fragments collected at the site yielded nothing conclusive.
Then we have one outstanding sample still at the lab. They're working on that, and they said they're going to let me have the data as soon as it's ready.
Okay, so we've got 2 individuals, possibly 3, and then the rest will be in a group burial.
Yeah, I'd go with that, yeah.
Sadly, Mary Porciello will not get the news she hoped for. None of the DNA matched hers. Her brother, co-pilot John Hanlon, was not identified. They did establish a genetic link for 2 of the crew members, mechanic Clarence Fridley from Montana and gunner James Palko of Wisconsin. Tom Raines, finally arriving at the site of the wreckage, won't find out for some time that his father was not identified among the remains.
So small. you know, in comparison to the landscape and the mountains and everything. And I don't know. I guess I was expecting it to be much larger for some reason and on a much grander and larger scale than it is. And it seems so small and somewhat insignificant. Not much to show for 7 crew members' lives. I guess my concern still is always about how they actually died, and hopefully it was quick, and maybe they were died on impact. Because I can't really imagine, in looking at this, how beautiful it looks and everything at this time of the year, how this place looks in March. It's got to be a pretty scary thing, especially if you are wounded or if you were hurt in the crash itself. Actually, I'm not too crazy about even thinking about that possibility of what it might have been.
But Ralph Wetterhahn has been thinking a lot about what happened on the last flight of Bomber 31. After examining the wreckage, he believes it met enemy fire before reaching its target on Shumshu Island. With the engines crippled, the pilots were looking for a place to land.
My sense is they were crossing this valley trying to make it to Petropavlovsk, about 35 miles to the north, where they'd be interned. And as they crossed the valley, with both engines damaged, it became apparent at some point that they were not going to make it. And looking to his right, Whitman probably saw this relatively flat area and turned into it. And he had one priority, and that was to not have a fire. He's got a bomb load, he's got tons of fuel on board, and he brings it in low, and he calls for Hanlon to shut off the mixtures, then to shut off the fuel valves, and drops a little bit of flaps. Then the battery and generators come off. And then in the last few hundred meters of silence, he brings it in and pulls up, touching down perfectly level. Both engine props dig into the deep snow. The engines are ripped from the wings, go underneath, and the aircraft continues on up the hill and comes to a stop. And there is no fire. They've done it. I think the crew survived the landing, though some of them may have been injured. You know, they had fuel to stay warm and a little bit of food. It looks like 4 died at the crash site, and the other 3 probably went for help at some point and perished in the appalling winter weather. And I suspect the bears dispose of their remains. No one will ever know for sure.
Japanese war records reveal that the airmen of Attu succeeded. They convinced the Japanese Imperial Command to divert about 1/6 of their air strength to defend the northern Kuril Islands from invasion.
These Navy men, they created a mission and they made a difference, because they could have all survived the war sitting there on Attu, drinking beer and smoking cigarettes while the rest of World War II happened, and they didn't. They took part in it.
A great nation never leaves behind its dead. You always go look for them, whether it's 10 years or 20 years or 50 years. We owe it to them and to their families to identify those people, to bring their bodies back so they can have a proper burial here in the United States.
The families of all the crew members can request a military burial in Arlington Cemetery. And then the case of Bomber 31 will finally be closed.
More than 88,000 American service personnel are missing from conflicts dating back to World War II. Find out more about the U.S. effort to
have what they call a hot wing. Remember, you see the ice and snow just disappear off the edge. But one of the things they did at those night missions, when they stopped to get topped off the fuel, they'd try to clean any ice or snow. Then we've talked about this a lot. They think one of the reasons why Whitman was the last one to take off was they were working on his airplane because it was icing up. And I can't remember how we took the ice off.
Was there any Japanese soldiers up there, or was the island completely eradicated from Japanese when you were up there?
Oh, no. There were some up there. I remember going with a couple of other people, friends of mine, over to the part of the island where that battle went on, and we found not any actual bodies, but for instance, one area where the American went ashore, we went up into the hills on the side and into different places where the Japanese must have been with their shooting down it. And we found candy wrappers with Japanese writing on them. Why anyway, I never kept any of that, I don't know. But there were things around there, you know, showing that the Japanese had been there.
Doris, how long were you actually there?
Well, first time we were there 9 months, and the second time 6 months. We were there when World War II ended. In fact, I was out flying a patrol that day when they announced it over the radio. We heard it on their radio in the airplane. So, but the war ended about, I think it was the 14th of August of 45. And on the 20th of August, our squadron took off. And the 21st of August, we landed at Seattle. Walked away from the airplane and never did see it again.
Well, I didn't care about that.
A little extra interesting note to that. That was the 21st of August. On the 25th of August, I got to home at Northbrook. And 26th of August, my wife went to the hospital in Evanston. And the 28th of August, our son was born. Just made it.
The occupation of Attu and I believe one or two other islands by the Japanese was the final point for the Americans was to build the Alaska Highway in order to get...
Well, the Alaska Highway went up along the mainland and it ended right up around Point Barrow, I think, which is still the mainland of Alaska. Now, the Aleutians were a string of islands that went out into the Pacific.
I know, but we expected to get invaded by the Japanese. So that's why they built the Alaska Highway.
Yeah.
To get the men equipment.
And in a hurry.
To supply.
42-43.
Yeah.
And just last June, they celebrated the 60th anniversary of the Alaska Highway.
I remember stopping on our way up there. We stopped at this picture shown here at Yakutat, a base there. And that was a base where We met, I didn't meet any of them, but Russian pilots would go there and pick up airplanes under lend-lease and fly them back over to Russia. And our pilots would take that far and drop them off. I don't know whether it was actually Yakutat or one of the other bases on the...
One of them was Fairbanks.
Was it Fairbanks? I never got to Fairbanks.
We painted out the white star and made it red. And then they were Russian planes.
That's right. Yeah.
I know when I first got to check out in a PV. See, I went through PBYs in flight training back in Jacksonville. And in December of 42, when I got my wings, a notice came out that anybody interested in flying land-based patrol could apply for it. Well, I applied for it and got it. And so the first thing we checked out in Sanford, Florida, was a SNB, or Twin Beach, with the plastic nose. And then we got what was known as a PBO, which is a Lockheed Hudson, which later turned into a Ventura. And Lockheed Hudsons were airplanes that we got back from England that had been sent over there under lend-lease. And we got the back and checked out in those, and they still had the British markings on them, the circle for Britain and on the fuselage. So we flew those for just a short while until we finally got the PV-1 checked out. But England really got the PV before we did.
Those things made by Lockheed?
Yes. They're built in Burbank, California. In fact, when we... Our squadron, EP-139, BB-139, it was called then, was training at Whidbey Island. We found out that we thought we were going to go to the South Pacific. But they changed it. Said, well, you're going to be going up into the Aleutians. Well, we didn't have the instruments for that, so our whole squadron flew down to Alameda, California, and about three or four planes at a time would go on down to Burbank, California, be there a couple of days, and they changed the instruments in the panel to get us ready to fly up in the Aleutian. So our planes in that first squadron had a different instrument panel than the other PVs had.
Morris, did you get any anti-aircraft fire or any jet fighter planes attack you when you were over by that island?
I didn't hear.
Were you attacked at all when you finally reached a Shumshu or whatever it was?
Oh, yeah, well, the second tour of duty, which is what I want to talk about some other time because that is an entirely different deal. That second one, 6 months, we were going over in the daytime then and making these low-level attacks that I talked about. I got jumped by fighters a couple times, and our tactic was just to go down on the deck, show everything forward and outrun them. The PV-1 would outrun a Zero. Or we didn't stay around and fight with them. We just ran away from them. I had two attack me one time. I was right on the deck, and they were up on one on each side, and they both made a run and turned, and as they turned, they fell behind us. that distance that they had covered meant that they would, a couple of people in the crew looked back. He could see the shells hitting the water, splashing into the water behind us.
Did that top turret help out in that, of course? The top turret they had in the plane, was that
In my case, no, but in one of the cases, one of the members of our squadron, in fact, we had two that were twins. They were both gunners on different crews. Well, one actually shot a zero down with the turret a couple of times. So that's one of the things we talk about. See, our squadron has been very close-knit ever since World War II. We've been in touch with each other. And we have reunions. And about every 2 or 3 years, we have a reunion. And just about everybody shows up for that. Except now, the latest, we keep a record of where everybody is at, where they live. But the latest thing I got was a list of people that are where they're living, and there's another list of those that have passed away. And that list, of course, is getting longer every time. We have one man who happens to be was my radio man the second time, named Will Swinney from Austin, Texas. After World War II, he went back to Austin, which is hometown, and went into law enforcement and became chief of police of Austin till he retired. Well, after he retired, he took it on himself to start tracking everybody down that was in the squadron. It was about 150 of us all together. And he's the one that I keep hearing from him. I talk to him on the phone every once in a while. And he's the one that found everybody. It took him, starting about 1985, I started hearing from him. I hadn't really thought much about the squadron all those years until about 85. I heard from Will Swinney, and he told me that he was trying to get people together to try to have a reunion. And that's developed into him actually pinpointing everybody that was in the squadron, which is a very unusual thing of all those people, and all that goes back that far to be able to do that. But he had that background. He was a detective. He'd keep dogging until he found somebody. Well, we got, there's one that was a friend of mine that we haven't found. That he was from Chicago area. He was one of the co-pilots of the second time up there. We've never found out what happened to him. That's one. And then there's another pilot from the first time up there, named Rio. We've never found out what happened to him.
Those were people who were discharged at the end of the war, and you can't find them.
Yeah, they just, we don't know what happened. But being the detective that he was pretty good at finding everybody. Every time I'd hear from him, the list that he had of the people that had been located kept getting longer until we finally got everybody. I've got the list at home now of the ones that are been located, and then the list of those who died and deceased.
Is the military in any way helpful in the locating people for you?
I really didn't do it, but Will Swinney, the one that did all this, I think he did somehow.
The government has no way of helping with that, though, do they?
Not that I know of. Yeah.